So the date was November 28th, 2008, and my son, Connell, and I had taken a trip to Vancouver because it was time for my then 14-year-old offspring to experience an important rite of passage, the AC/DC concert. Now, in all honesty, I'm not sure that Con was really that much burning to go to this, but I was. And I suppose I'm really confessing this to you, my church community, friends to whom I'm accountable. And yes, perhaps the presbytery's waiting for your call to discipline me for this action, but we'll see. Now, for those of you who aren't familiar with the band AC/DC, they're a blues-based rock band from Australia. Been kicking around since the early 1970s. Sold about a trillion records, all of which sound the same. But I would say it's a good kind of the same. And they've made a ridiculous amount of money pretending to be a bit naughty. They're not really. So Connell and I, we took a trip to General Motors Place to join what was a surprisingly intergenerational crowd. There was everything from kids to grandparents, all wearing the same tacky black AC/DC t-shirts. And honestly, we watched the band put on a really, really good show. I loved it. I didn't buy a t-shirt. They were too expensive, but loved the show all the same. Anyway, the following day, we're heading back home on the ferry. And we're sitting there, both of us reading. And I look up, and I see a woman sitting there. She's probably about 30 years of age. She's holding a baby, and she's like maybe 10 feet away. And suddenly, I get this sense that I am supposed to go and speak with her. Honestly, I had the sense that God wanted me to go and say something to her. I had no idea what I was supposed to say, but I did have this strong feeling I was supposed to be having a conversation with her. And you know, God works this way. God says, I want you to go do this. I will give you what you need to go do this when it's needed. I, on the other hand, tend to work this way. I will do this, God, if I know what I'm doing and why I'm doing it. I'll do it only after I know those things. So you can see that there's a wee bit of a gap between those two ways of being. So, as you can imagine, I got a bit scared by this because there was a social line I was being asked to cross. At least I think I was being asked to cross. This woman was young enough to be my daughter. And I'm now thinking, what if she sees me coming up to her as some sort of creepy old guy trying to chat her up? So I'm now wondering if I'm entering into some sort of professional death trap, all because of some misunderstanding, which is actually a real concern in a vocation that requires careful treading through those rather dangerous fields of spiritual intimacy. Things can get really misunderstood. Things can get confused. So as you might guess, I'm thinking that I'll be getting a response like, hit the road, you creepy loser. Or maybe even worse. Worse is that she would laugh at me. So I keep looking at her. I hope I'm looking at her surreptitiously. But I'm wondering if this is a legitimate word from God, or maybe it's the residual effect of something I ate at GM Place the night before. You know? And so I do nothing. Okay? It's now nearly 7 years since I was involved in that near incident. And I still think about it. Now, I don't beat myself up too badly, because if it was God speaking to me, then I trust that God will surely send someone else to her, someone with much more courage than I have. And I have some assurance about that, because I really believe that ours is a good God, a great shepherd of the sheep who will find and care for one lost sheep somehow. But, you know, when I stop to think about it, I wonder if maybe I was the lost sheep that day. Maybe God was rounding me up in some way through that experience. See, I thought I was on my way home from a concert, but maybe God actually had another task for me. Maybe God was trying to teach me something important. This morning's gospel reading from Mark 5 is an interesting one in that it's a bit unusual. It's a story within a story, and that can be just a touch confusing for us. Not that I think Mark is deliberately trying to confuse us with this. Rather, I think that Mark is trying to connect these stories in some way to make sure that we see that there's some commonality in them. There's also the very distinct possibility that this is just the way it happened. That's actually one of the ways that I've preached on this text before. I know I went back and I looked. I've preached that those interruptions that we experience may actually be the most important thing that God wants us to be about in a particular day. I'm going to do A, B happens, and actually B was the point of the whole exercise. But I think there's something else for us in the text this morning. Jesus has been crisscrossing the Sea of Galilee with his group of disciples, with the 12. And he has just come back from a fairly spectacular exorcism on the Gentile side of the sea. He has now incurred the wrath of a group of pig farmers who'd seen their stock plunge off a bank into a watery grave, which is kind of a strange story itself. At least it is to my ears. Anyway, he's now back on the Jewish side of Galilee, and he's quickly approached by someone whose name is Jairus. And we discover that Jairus is a prominent person in the local synagogue. I would say that Jairus' position was rather like being the chair of the official board at St. Stephen's United Church. As our present chair, Dave Ney, knows, as Todd Starkey before him, as Susan Lee before Todd, this means that, of course, he is endlessly respected in the town. Okay. He's a small fish in a small pond. But Jairus is kind of a someone, at least in the synagogue. We also know that Jesus' relationship with the leadership in the synagogues is at best a little uneven, and at times it's quite rocky. The good news that Jesus is preaching doesn't always sound especially like good news to some of the synagogue leaders. And that makes Jairus' approach all the more telling. Because, you see, Jairus is desperate. He has a daughter who is sick to the point of being near death, and he will do anything. He will do absolutely anything to see her get well. And I would say that probably many of us, if not all of us here, understand what Jairus is feeling. So he comes to Jesus, he gets on his knees, and he begs him to lay hands on her, to heal her. And not surprisingly to our ears, Jesus agrees and goes with this most anxious dad. Off the two of them go. So that's the bread layer of this Markan sandwich. That's what some biblical scholars call this, a Markan sandwich. We'll see this phenomenon also in chapter 11 of Mark's gospel when we come across the story of the fig tree and the cleansing of the temple. It's another example of this. So the story of Jairus' daughter is the bread portion of the sandwich. Now we're going to turn our eyes to the filling. They're on their way to Jairus' home, and they've attracted this large crowd of looky-loos, the crowd of people who just want to see what happens. And it's probably a combination of concerned family and friends. There are probably some dubious religious folk. And then there's simply those who want to see the show, because, to be honest, there's probably not much going on in town. In the midst of the crowd is a woman who has been sick with a serious gynecological problem. She has been troubled by a bleed for the past 12 years. And it's been a really, really rough time. She has been to every emergency department in Galilee. She has been seen by every doctor and any doctor who will take her money. She has called Dr. Oz. She has gone to Sidon to seek alternative medical treatment. She's tried every home remedy, quack treatment, obscure therapy that she could find, and nothing. In fact, her situation is now worse because not only is she more ill, but she's also now dead broke, pretty much beyond hope. Again, this is still not an unfamiliar story for us, is it? But she'd heard about this itinerant rabbi, and once again, she thought, perhaps for the 500th time, she thought, okay, this will be it. This is the way I'm going to get cured. But of course, because of her illness, she was considered ritually unclean. And so just marching up to Jesus would have been well beyond what was culturally allowed. And so what she did, she rather cunningly blended into the crowd. And she sidled her way up beside Jesus. And just when she knew that no one would notice, she touched Jesus' cloak. And wouldn't you know it, she was instantly healed, and she knew it. But so did Jesus. That is, Jesus knew that something had happened. And Mark tells us that he could feel the power flowing out of himself. And in the midst of this great crowd, he says something that causes the disciples to look at him with incredulity, if not some gentle mockery. He says, "Who touched me?" And shaking their heads, the disciples say, it's more like, "Who didn't touch you, Jesus? Everybody and their dogs all over you, boss." But Jesus, he keeps looking around, and the woman, rather embarrassed, I'd guess, she steps forward and she tells him her tale of woe, and it really is a terrible story. And Jesus says something interesting. He says, "Daughter," I want you to remember that. He says, "Daughter, your faith has made you well. Go in peace." And then the scene shifts back to the bread and the sandwich. He's barely said the words, "Go in peace," when some concerned citizens and disaster vultures arrive, and they say to Jairus, "Your daughter's dead. You don't be needing to bother Jesus any longer." Nicely delivered message, eh? Really sensitive group. Nonetheless, Jesus hears this, and he says to Jairus, "You don't need to be afraid. Just need to believe." And then he turns to Peter, James, and John, and he asks them to come with him, and they head to the family home, and it's a scene of all sorts of healthy histrionics, and I say it's healthy because it's quite healing. The crowd grieves the girl's death in what is the culturally expected fashion. There's much weeping and wailing and gnashing of teeth, and he walks into the house, and it's also filled with weeping people. Probably some of the people are actually professional mourners. That's what they do. They're there on the scene mourning with the family. And he asks, "So why are you all so upset? Because after all, she's not really dead. She's just sleeping." And they respond. The crowd responds in the most interesting way. They laugh at him. And it's not that kind of nice kind of laughter. It's that mocking, derisive kind of laughter. The same kind that he would eventually hear when he's on the cross. The kind of laughter we reserve for people who said or done something really, really stupid. But again, he ignores this pushback, and he gets mom and dad to take him to the now dead child, and he takes her by the hand, and he says, "Time to get up, little one." And the child, whom we now learn is 12 years old, she's actually on the edge of adulthood, at least in that time and place. She's just shy of a marriageable age. She indeed gets up, all hale and hearty, and apparently with an appetite. And thus ends this rather intriguing tale. And perhaps we're wondering how these two stories relate, but they do indeed relate. Mark has left us with some things, some clues that tie these stories together, that call us to find this common thread. Of course, they're both healing stories. They're both stories that deal with parties who are absolutely desperate, who are willing to do anything. Jairus is prepared to drop his fear of the kerfuffle that was going to happen by his going to Jesus. Because back in the synagogue, Jesus is a very controversial figure. But Jairus is that distressed. And the woman, she's prepared to do something that's just beyond the pale. She is going to touch a man who wasn't her husband or her relative. And that's a barrier that is compounded by her ritually unclean state. And so both of these individuals would be considered ritually unclean. And Jesus being in contact with either of them, someone who's bleeding, someone who is dead, that would be something that would be frowned upon. These are actions that cross the acceptable boundaries of the day. And there's also a reversal in each story. They are both given new life as a result of Jesus crossing the boundary by touching them. The woman with the bleed, she's had it for 12 years. And yes, the child, we're told, is how old? 12 years old. It's exactly the same time. And then, what else is there? There's 12 disciples, and there's 12 tribes. And 12 is a really important number in Jewish and Christian theology. It crops up all over the place. So I think that 12 is more than an odd detail. It's a connection. And Jesus calls the hemorrhaging woman daughter. And of course the other is the daughter of Jairus. So these stories, they're intertwined. They are linked. They are stories of people who are as good as dead, who are renewed, who are resurrected, who are given life by the touch of Jesus. And I would say that that life he gives is as available today as it was then. Which brings me to my point for today. A point I believe, and I hope, is the point of our text. In the end, both of these stories are stories of fear and faith. Both stories about Jesus' power to move people from one place of fear to the other place of faith. Here's the key. Jesus is never about fear. We need to remember that in the church. Jesus is never about fear. And as Andy commented, all churches are finding themselves in places of uncertainty today. And sometimes we respond to that with fear. But Jesus is never about fear. So when we do find ourselves afraid, a natural response to threat, we need to stop and locate the lie that we are now believing. Because Jesus is not about fear. And you know what really leapt out at me about this passage? It's that they laughed at Jesus. They laughed at Jesus when he said that Jairus' daughter was not dead but only sleeping. And his disciples, even if they didn't actually laugh out loud at him when he asked in the midst of the crowd, "Who touched me?" they certainly thought he had a bit of a screw loose here somewhere. They questioned what he was about. Like, come on, Jesus, it's a crowd of people. But here's the thing. In either case, Jesus did not respond to that. It just bounced right off him. And he just kept heading in the direction that God was leading him. Honestly, there are times when I find being a follower of Jesus to be really challenging. And when I slip into fear, especially when the Holy Spirit gives me an opportunity or prompts me to share the good news in some way, to speak about my faith, even to reveal the fact that I'm one of Jesus' people, and I do know that kind of fear too. Sometimes it's just the fear of embarrassment. That's what I was reminded of on the ferry that day. It can be really hard. And I know it's so much easier to just let it slide. But revealing our orientation toward Jesus, it can lead us to places that could potentially, places that get us laughed at, or much worse. And so we get afraid, don't we? But here's the thing. The crowd may laugh, but for the person who is in need, in this case, the sick woman, in this case, a dead girl, in this case, a heartbroken family, this is the gift of life. And we would withhold that out of embarrassment? Whenever Jesus was confronted by moments like this, and he was confronted by lots of them, He remained true to his mission. He never forgot the urgency of his mission. He was always about lifting up the other. He counted the need of others as worthy of the risk of embarrassment, as worthy of the risk of scorn, as worthy at the end of death. Even at the end, what was it? It was, Father, forgive them. It was always about the well-being of the other. So as I've been doing now for the last 6 weeks, actually 8 weeks, I'd like to end with a question. And it's a question about moving us from fear to faith. In what way this coming week might I risk? No, actually, I'm going to qualify it a bit more. Let me reduce the risk to you just a little bit. In what small way might I risk this coming week communicating to someone around me, that I'm a follower of Jesus? So you got that? Here's the question again. In what small way might I risk this coming week communicating to someone around me that I'm simply a follower of Jesus? Sisters and brothers, may God inspire you and strengthen you and bless you in this very important task. Amen.